From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actress Jodie Foster. She entered the business at age 3 as TV's Coppertone Girl, and went on to make such films as Taxi Driver, The Silence of the Lambs, and The Accused. She's won 2 Academy Awards, and her film Panic Room is now out on video and DVD. Also, Garrison Keillor tells us about his new autobiographical novel, Lake Wobegon Summer 1956, about a 14-year-old who discovers pornography and his own urge to write. The book is now out in paperback. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Paul Schrader's new film, Autofocus. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. French President Jacques Chirac says the use of force should be the last resort in an international crisis. France has been leading opposition to an American UN resolution which would prepare for a military strike on Iraq. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
Jacques Chirac made the comment in Beirut during a summit of French-speaking nations. The French president said the world had to resist temptations of adventure. He added that the logic of international legitimacy must apply to Iraq as much as to Africa and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Chirac said the use of force should only be allowed in the case of self-defense or following a decision by international authorities. That's the line France is defending at the United Nations as diplomats pore over the latest American draft resolution on Iraq. France wants the UN to have a final say in the use of force, not Washington. But Chirac said Iraq must help avert war by disarming. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
Police in Fairfax County, Virginia, have charged a man who allegedly claimed to have seen a sniper kill his 9th victim in the Washington, D.C. area. 37-year-old Matthew Dowdy faces a misdemeanor charge of making false statements to police. Dowdy allegedly told police that he saw a man emerge from a cream-colored van, raise an AK-74 rifle, and fire the shot that killed a 47-year-old woman outside a Home Depot store Monday night. Police now say the story was completely made up. If he's convicted, the witness could face up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. The United States is urging Americans to leave Ivory Coast despite a truce agreement between rebels and the government in the West African nation. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
While State Department spokesman Richard Boucher welcomed a truce in Ivory Coast, he warned the situation there is unstable.
The situation in the country remains volatile, it remains fluid. There is still violence, and we think it's prudent to take this step.
The State Department has ordered family members of diplomats and all non-essential embassy employees to leave Ivory Coast. It also issued a travel warning urging U.S. citizens to depart and call off plans to travel there. There are conflicting reports about whether the ceasefire is holding. The conflict that started with a bloody coup attempt in mid-September has intensified ethnic divisions in a country that had been stable and is a regional economic leader. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Social Security Administration has announced the smallest cost of living increase in about 4 years, 1.4%. The increase is based on inflation, and it's designed to help the nation's 46 million Social Security recipients keep up with the rising cost of living. The latest increase will begin showing up on checks in January. In stocks, the Dow gained 47 points to close at 8,322 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 15, or 1.2%, to close at 1,287. This is NPR News. The crew of Space Shuttle Atlantis is back on Earth following today's landing at the Kennedy Space Center. The astronauts spent a week with their spacecraft docked to the International Space Station. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
Astronaut Commander Jeff Ashby and co-pilot Pam Melroy took turns at the control stick during final approach. Then Ashby guided the spacecraft down to the Kennedy Space Center's runway at an angle of descent 7 times steeper than a commercial jetliner. Now that the shuttle is safely on the ground, NASA has questions to answer regarding Atlantis's blastoff. There was a problem with the system that releases the shuttle's solid rocket boosters at liftoff. Explosive charges fire at booster ignition to send the spacecraft on its way. The primary system fired normally, but the backup charges didn't fire the way they were supposed to. Mission managers are looking into the problem. The Atlantis astronauts delivered a new section of the International Space Station's aluminum outer frame. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
A federal appeals court in Michigan said today that the state of Michigan can test welfare recipients for drug use. The appeals panel reversed a lower court ruling that said the drug testing program was unconstitutional. The lower court stopped a pilot program that called for some communities to screen welfare applicants for drug use before they could be considered for benefits. Applicants who tested positive for drugs could have their benefits gradually taken away if they failed to take drug treatment. Opponents of the drug testing program say it's unconstitutional because it tests adults who've given no other reason for suspicion of drug use. In stocks today, the broad-based S&P 500 gained 5 points to close at 884. For the week, the S&P 500 gained 49. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from United Artists, presenting Bowling for Columbine, the new film from Michael Moore, the director of Roger and Me and author of Stupid White Men, now playing at select theaters.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jodie Foster has been in the public eye ever since the age of 3, when she was the Coppertone girl on TV commercials. She made Disney movies as a child, but at the age of 12 and a half took the bold move of playing a child prostitute in the now classic film Taxi Driver. As an adult, she's won 2 Oscars, one for her role as a rape victim in The Accused, the other as FBI agent Clarice in Silence of the Lambs. From Taxi Driver on, Foster's made some bold and unusual career choices, like starring in Carl Sagan's metaphysical space drama Contact and not starring in Hannibal, the sequel to Silence of the Lambs. Instead, Julianne Moore played Clarice, while Foster starred in other movies, like the action drama Panic Room, now out on video and DVD, and the less mainstream The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys, which will be released on video and DVD next month. When Terry last spoke with Jodie Foster, after Altar Boys was completed, she asked the actress about taking her first serious role in a movie and whether it was an easy decision.
When you were 12 and a half and got the part in Taxi Driver, was your mother afraid of what you'd be exposed to playing a child prostitute?
Well, you know, first of all, I had been an actor since I was 3 years old, so I had a long body of experience. And my mom really took me to all sorts of movies and took me to R-rated movies whenever she could. And, you know, we talked a lot about politics and we talked about deeper things. And I grew up in Hollywood, so I was exposed to it all over the place. I knew the work of Martin Scorsese and knew what an artist he was and had seen Mean Streets and had also done Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore with him. So I don't really think it was that big of a consideration. It was a consideration, for example, for the Board of Education. And at that time, they weren't, you know, they really wanted to know that I would not be emotionally damaged by playing this part. So they brought in my lawyers brought in a psychologist to decipher after an hour of meeting me to decipher whether I would be, you know, entirely damaged by my atmosphere.
Let me just play a scene from this film.
Okay.
In this film, you know, Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, wants to rescue you from a life of prostitution. He's just kind of taking you as a cause. You know, you're a 12-and-a-half-year-old kid or a 13-year-old kid who's being sold by a pimp, played by Harvey Keitel. And so De Niro goes to Keitel and buys some time with you, not to have sex with you, but to convince you to let him rescue you from this life. So here you are in a room together for the first time. He wants to change your life. You want to give him his money's worth because he just bought some time with you. Let's hear an excerpt of that scene.
What's your name?
Easy.
Well, that's not any kind of name.
Oh, it's easy to remember.
Yeah, well, what's your real name?
I don't like my real name.
Well, what's your real name?
Iris.
Well, what's wrong with that? That's a nice name.
That's what you think.
Now, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't you remember me? You mean, remember when you got into a taxi? It was a checkered taxi. You got in and that guy Matthew came by and he said he wanted to take you away? He pulled you away?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember any of that?
No.
Well, that's all right. I'm going to get you out of here.
So we better make it, or Sport will get mad. So how do you want to make it?
I don't want to make it. Who's Sport?
Oh, that's Matthew. I call him Sport. Want I'll make it like this.
At the end of this scene, Jodie Foster, you're unzipping De Niro's fly.
Mm-hmm.
Were you old enough yet to get what this was about?
Yes. Yeah. And 12-year-olds are. And I think we're all very foolish and blind to think that they don't. You know, I lived in L.A. I lived in an urban place, and I'd seen a lot of movies, and you know, I had long talks with my mom, and sort of the way I approached my character was this was a runaway and somebody who probably was taking a lot of drugs and who'd really been under the influence of an older man, and somebody who would run away from a kind of an oppressive family structure. Boy, I understood all that. And, you know, I went to a private school where I wore a little gray skirt, and I got straight A's and spoke different languages, and I mean, I don't think I'm scarred.
I was going to ask you.
You never know. Yeah, but I don't think I'm scarred.
I was going to ask you if you felt you walked away with any scars. Guess not.
Well, no. And in fact, I think in some ways it's good to, if you know your child and if you know your child is ready for having these kinds of discussion, it's good in some ways to show them the adult world when they're still open to having conversations about you know, meaningful paths and what makes an unmeaningful life and things like that.
Taxi Driver is such an extraordinary movie. I mean, it's at the top of or near the top of so many people's lists, and so many of us have seen it, you know, over and over again. I'm thinking, you know, at the age of 12 and a half to work with Scorsese and De Niro and Keitel. You know, gee.
It really changed my life. At that time, I had made many more movies than either one of them had, but...
oh, God, that's so amazing.
But I had played mostly, you know, people used to ask of me, you know, act naturally, be yourself.
Uh-huh.
Say that line just as you would say that line. And it just never occurred to me that being an actor was ever going to be some kind of a satisfying career, because it just seemed dumb to me. You just, you know, read the lines someone else wrote, and there wasn't a lot of thought into it, and there was no building of a character. And it really wasn't until I met Rob De Niro and he kind of took me under his wing and sat down with me for hours at a time that I really understood that there was more to acting than just being a puppet.
If you remembered, I'd love to hear some of the things he told you in those talks about acting.
Well, I wish that he had had some kind of, wonderful, miraculous things to say to me. Mostly he would take me to these little divey coffee shops in different parts of town, sometimes in Spanish Harlem and different parts of town that he found. And he didn't talk to me much. He just let me sit there. And after a while, I realized that this was his, you know, he was going to do this again, you know, for another hour. So I just looked around. I'd talk with other people, and I'd go on my merry way and, you know, read the newspaper occasionally. And after a while, he might bring in the script, and we'd start working on the script, and he'd do the lines over and over and over again. And having been a child actor, of course, I knew my lines. So now I was really bored because I'd have to do these lines over and over again with this adult. And then by the end of our meetings, he would throw improvisation in. And that was, I think, a really good lesson, because I suddenly learned that improvisation was about knowing the text so well that you could deviate from it in a meaningful way, as if you were had been living this conversation, and always find your way back to the text. And I think that's a lesson that most young actors don't really get.
Do you think that he took you to divey coffee shops, as you described them, because he thought maybe you'd see characters like the character you were playing?
You know, I think it was just his way of getting me to feel comfortable with him, and I don't think he really knew what he had in mind. At that, you know, Robert De Niro then and Robert De Niro now are two very different guys.
Mm-hmm.
Then he was a guy who made one film every 2 years or 3 years. He immersed himself in the character. He barely ever slept when he was doing Taxi Driver. He was a mess. I mean, he was living the character of Travis Bickle, and so his method in some ways was just to live in that place and to try and drag me into it.
Did Martin Scorsese give you any advice about your character or about working with the actors in the film?
Well, he brought in a girl that he had met that had had similar circumstances. You know, a very thin, very young girl who had some of the mannerisms that he wanted me to copy, and he kind of pointed them out to me. And that's pretty much all he did. And then he did a lot of takes at that time. He shot a lot of film and did a lot of takes. And I remember the one thing that I remember about him that I think is the most inspiring to me as a director is that he used to sit behind the camera, of course, back then when there were no video monitors that directors could hide behind. He'd sit behind the camera, and sometimes we'd do, I don't know, 30 takes, 40 takes, but every take he would laugh. He would giggle and have to hold his mouth shut so that he wouldn't make noise. And not just the first or the second take, but every take, he was actually enjoyed the performances so much that it was almost as if he was inside the actors' faces.
Jodie Foster is my guest. One of your most popular films is Silence of the Lambs, in which you play an FBI agent on the trail of a serial killer. No problems with that film in terms of the violence in it, or just, I'm just wondering if it was like creepy for you to deal with that kind of material after the whole Hightley affair.
Well, I love Silence of the Lambs, and I certainly, I love the book, and it was something that I pursued actively. Because I did feel that the perspective in the movie, the point of view of the film, was from the point of view of a young person who believed that her destiny was to save people. And that is the point of view of the camera of that movie. A very different point of view than, of course, being the cannibal or the serial killer himself and looking at the world around him with those eyes on. I did feel that the film is defendable, that it is it has the right point of view. I think Silence is a wonderful film, and I really felt like it needed to be made, and there was a part of me that felt that was terribly drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
I had played a lot of victims in my life, and you know, if you asked me at the time why I was playing victims, I would have said, well, you're crazy, what are you even talking about? I don't play victims. But when you look back on my work, you see a pattern, you see an unconscious pattern. Silence of the Lambs in some ways was the end of that pattern, because it was the first time that I played somebody whose destiny was to save them. Something that she knew as a small girl, something that she knew before she was born. There was a part of her that was drawn and who's destined to find those marginalized women out there, or those women who were too fat, too thin, too small, too quiet, and to be their saviors.
Let me play a short scene from Silence of the Lambs. And you play an FBI agent who's searching for trying to track down a serial killer, and as part of your search, you go visit Hannibal Lecter, who is the serial killer who killed and ate his victims. You're visiting him in prison where he's serving life, and you think he'll have clues about this serial killer you're trying to track down. Hannibal Lecter is played by Anthony Hopkins. This is your first meeting with him, in which you're trying to get information from him, and he's both testing you and playing with you at the same time.
Tell me, what did Miggs say to you? Multiple Miggs in the next cell. He hissed at you. What did he say?
He said, I can smell your...
I see. I myself cannot. You use Evian skin cream. And sometimes you wear lead at home. But not today.
Did you do all these wrongs, Doctor?
Ah. That is the Duomo scene from the Belvedere. Do you know Florence?
All that detail just from memory, sir?
Memory, Agent Starling, is what I have instead of a view.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
No. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire. It won't do.
I'm only asking you to look at this, Doctor. Either you will or you won't.
Jodie Foster, can you talk a little bit about working opposite Anthony Hopkins in these scenes with him?
Oh, he's such a wonderful actor and such a truly nice man, one of the great nice men. I was kind of scared to death of him. The only time that I'd met him was at a rehearsal, and we'd started, you know, rehearsing right away, you know, he brought that voice out, and I kind of got scared of him. And for some reason, during the shooting, we were always behind glass. You know, he was either behind glass or I was behind glass. So we never really got to hang out together at all. And I was kind of scared of him the whole movie. And then one day, over tuna fish sandwiches at the end of the film, I admitted it to him, and finally he admitted to me, I was kind of scared of you, too. And it was sort of a very funny moment, and from then on, I think we've become much more comfortable with each other.
Now, you're using a Southern accent. I'm not sure exactly which state it's supposed to be from.
She's originally from West Virginia, but had been transplanted to Montana, so has lost her accent slightly.
Mm-hmm. So why was it felt that an accent was needed for the role?
That was a choice of the director, and also very much a big part of the novel. She's somebody who is from the South and is not from the Tony family that others in the FBI have come from. Mm-hmm. She was, orphaned at a young age and was thrust into living with people that didn't really want her. So it creates a character for Clarice, who's somebody who is very much like a lot of these victims that the killer has been killing. That's her background. She's a nobody from nowhere. And the accent, I think, is very important. It's a fuel to Hannibal Lecter because he can glean parts of her past through her voice, things that she'd love to cover up. It's her weakness.
Jodie Foster speaking with Terry Gross. They'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to more of Terry's interview with Jodie Foster, recorded last spring.
I want to ask you about one other movie, The Accused, in which mm-hmm. you play somebody who is raped. I don't know if you're the kind of actress who does a lot of elaborate preparation before a role, or if you just, you know, kind of go and do mm-hmm. it. But
It depends.
I mean, it's certainly not the role you can prepare for.
You can't
prepare
for a role like that.
Right.
You really can't. I mean, if it was, if you're playing Henry VIII, you kind of know that you got to go look through some books and do some stuff. But to play somebody who's in the wrong place at the wrong time, mm-hmm. There really isn't a lot of research to be done. I mean, there is the building of a character. You say she walks like this and she talks like this and these are the people that she knows and this is her education and her background. We can't forget that I was young when I made that movie, so I was doing a lot of unconscious denying. I remember specifically that I read the script literally once before I went to do the movie. And I think it was because partly I was scared, and I just didn't even want to think about how I was going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of typical, I think, of 25-year-olds, that you know you're drawn towards something and psychologically, but you don't really know why, and you don't even want to ask yourself the question. You just kind of dive head first. And, of course, had I been 40, maybe I wouldn't have taken that movie.
So did that put you in the position of doing more improvisatory reaction for the rape scene than you've improvised in other films?
Well, no, I wouldn't say there was much improvisation. With a scene like that, you really can't be improvised because you don't want to have to repeat it 50 times.
Right.
It's too painful for everyone, not just me, but for the boys, for the men playing the rapists. Mm-hmm. It was, of course, much harder on them than it was on me, typical. And I spent a lot of time kind of getting them through it because in some ways I had the self-righteous part. You know, I had the one who knew that she was on the correct side of the argument. And it was hard for them to play what they had to play. So I did not want them improvising because I just didn't want a lot of broken bones and a lot of pain.
Right.
So we did actually, in rehearsals, kind of go through studiously and figure out what it was going to be. But at the same time, nobody can really tell you what that moment's going to be like. And even though every inch of it was choreographed, through some of the scenes, I absolutely cannot remember what happened after they said action and between cut. I just don't remember. I remember before and I remember after, but I don't remember during.
Can you watch your own films, and are some of your films easier for you to watch than others? I imagine watching the rape scene in The Accused is not like a great time for you.
Right. Well, I do watch the movies right after I've done them and through the process of cutting them and the beginning of the previews and all that kind of stuff. And then once the movie's out, I never can watch them again. Occasionally, I'll catch one on, pay-per-view or HBO or something, and I kind of cringe and have to turn it off. I just can't sit through it.
Can you explain why?
I don't know. I guess it's a moment that's passed, and you've lived it so much and so intensely, but you just don't want to go back there again. As part of you just doesn't want to go back there again, and you do feel self-conscious about it because you have seen it either so many times or you've lived it so many times, you've talked about it so many times. You just are not ready to live through it again.
When you went to Yale, I remember it really made news. It was on TV, it was in the newspapers, and everybody was wondering, what's it going to be like for this young movie star to be a student at a university? So, I mean, in retrospect, was it possible for you to like just be a student there, or did you feel like you were sticking out all the time?
Well, it was a wonderful moment in my life. I'm so glad that I did that, and it was a big step to take. At that time, really, no other young actors had ever done that, sort of left their careers and said, I'm going to get an education. But it was had always been phenomenally important to me, and I just never knew I was going to be an actor when I grew up. In fact, it was the farthest thing from my mind. I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll act for a few years when I'm 16 or 17, and then that'll be it. No one will want me anymore, which is pretty much what everybody had told me would happen. Yes, I did think that I was somehow going to have this anonymity, and for the first time in my life, I actually felt that. I really felt like I was living without any kind of scrutiny, without the eyes of everybody on me. And unfortunately, my freshman year, assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan kind of shattered that, and very quickly I realized that that hadn't been true at all, and that people had been watching me all along. And then, of course, it became a mad media circus, and my life in college really kind of changed from then on. But then after that, I sort of moved off campus and had a new life in college, and things did die down somewhat. And it truly was the best time in my life. I mean, I don't know who I'd be if I hadn't been there.
Did you study acting when you were at Yale?
I studied no acting when I was at Yale. Not that I could have, because, you know, that's liberal arts education in their mind is really about... It's not a trade school. I didn't study any theater at all, although that was certainly available to me. I really wanted to learn about literature. That was my passion. I loved reading. I had always loved reading, and that was the place that I saw for myself. I really wanted to stay as far away from acting as I could, and even as far away from kind of the real world as I could. I'd been paying taxes since I was 3 years old, and I really wanted to be in an ivory tower for once.
Jodie Foster, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Jodie Foster speaking with Terry Gross last spring. Foster's movie Panic Room is out on video and DVD. Her latest film, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys, will be joining it next month. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Discovery Channel, presenting Behind the Headlines, a television event featuring Understanding Iraq and the Real Saddam, tonight at 9 p.m. on the Discovery Channel, and from Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Ella Minow P. by Mark Dunn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lake Wobegon, summer 1956. Garrison Keillor's autobiographical novel about the summer of a 14-year-old boy is out in paperback. Coming up, we talk with him about it. Also, David Edelstein reviews Autofocus, the new film by Paul Schrader. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Best-selling writer and humorist Garrison Keillor's latest novel, Lake Wobegon's Summer 1956, is now out in paperback. It's set in the fictional town he made famous on his long-running public radio program, A Prairie Home Companion. It's about a 14-year-old named Gary, who, like more than a few boys that age, has discovered pornography and his own sexual urges. In Gary's case, this comes with a big sense of shame. He hides what he's reading and what he's thinking and worries that he's headed straight to hell. At the same time, he's found another lonely but deep passion. He's discovered that he loves to write. Gary has gotten his hands on his own typewriter, he started writing about sports for the local paper, and he started to experiment with different ways of describing the world around him just for the fun of it. Terry spoke with Keillor last year when Lake Wobegon's Summer 1956 was first published. Their conversation included a brief reading from the book, with Garrison himself setting the scene.
Here's a boy who's 14 years old sitting on a porch in the summer of 1956 in Lake Wobegon. He's holding a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, required reading among fundamentalists, and tucked into the book is a magazine, a gift from a classmate, High School Orgies, with suggestive stories of people who suddenly fell in love and in the next minute were naked, and some photographs of them. This pornographic magazine and the pictures of naked people makes the boy remember how he himself looks in photographs and in a home movie that Daddy took last Christmas. I look like a tree toad who was changed into a boy, but not completely. There's still plenty of toadness there. The dark amphibian eyes blinking, the pipe stem arms and wrists, the high water pants, the flappy clown shoes, the Herkimer hair, the steel rim glasses. No sensible woman would marry a guy this creepy. Take a look, and you see this person will never be a normal American. He will live alone and suffer from psoriasis and hemorrhoids and halitosis and earn dollars at home through taxidermy and selling salve. And he will never have true friends, only other geeks who remind him too painfully of himself. But what choice does he have? So he meets them at the spastic center to compare stamp collections, play chess, solve algebra problems, do geek-type things. He may never obtain a driver's license. He'll ride his Schwinn bike to and from Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, and his old classmates will zoom past in their late model cars and think, whatever happened to old Gary, the creepo, the spaz? Haven't seen hide nor hair of him for years. Zoom, and there I am, the old guy on a bike, the old galoot who totes his necessaries around in a plastic bag, a rubber band around his pants leg, reflective tape plastered on the sleeves and back of his plaid jacket, a reflector pinned to the back of his hunting cap, eating a Little Debbie snack cake. You thrill me so, she whispered as she kissed him, her back arched, her luscious orbs gleaming in the moonlight. This type of thing will not happen for that guy any more than he will sing and dance in a Broadway musical. That guy's love stick will never be a love stick that any babe thinks of with anything but mute disgust. The high school orgy story about the boy in home ec class, this will not happen for me. The girls are sewing dresses, and the boy sews a tiny leopard skin bathing suit and models it for them. The girls inspect it closely, admiring the handiwork. And suddenly he bursts a seam, and soon they're all naked, their love juices flowing. I find this tremendously exciting, those girlish fingers poking at his pouch. I am going to hell. This is becoming increasingly clear. As Aunt Flo says, you don't get to be a Christian by sitting in church any more than sleeping in a garage makes you a car. What sort of Christian can open up high school orgies to the picture of the home ec girl's breasts with pointy nipples and feel that happy twitching in his shorts?
Garrison, thanks for reading that. And that's an excerpt of Garrison Keillor's new novel, Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. Is this a new turn for you, writing about a boy who's learning about sex and is constantly being aroused by what he reads and is, of course, constantly guilty by reading it and by being aroused by it?
I'm going to just sit here and cry for a while, I think. That passage was, that passage that you made me read was much too personal and makes me feel terrible. But that's why I went into radio. And yes, it is a new turn, and it all started back the last time we talked, and you asked me a question which you then sort of withdrew about my sexual awakening. And it was your withdrawal of the question, as if this might even be an embarrassing thing to talk about, or too personal or something, that made me think, maybe I ought to write about that. So I did. Wrote a book about myself, and then surrounded myself with all of these fictional people.
Well, did you have to, like, steel yourself to write about the discovery of sexuality? Was it really difficult, painful, too personal?
It's painful to think of how I looked at the age of 14, but it's very pleasant to write about this particular summer, a summer in which the discovery of erotic feelings and a sweet romance with my own cousin was all tied in with becoming a writer and experiencing life as best you can when you're 14 in a small town in the Midwest.
Garrison, I'm still kind of thinking about what you said, that it was that question about awakening to your own sexuality that led you to think about writing this book. I mean, if that's true, I'm wondering, like, when you came across something that seemed too personal to discuss, is that when you thought, well, maybe if it makes me uncomfortable, I should go there, I should get deeper into it?
It didn't make me uncomfortable, it made you uncomfortable.
Oh, well, it made me uncomfortable because I thought it made you uncomfortable.
No, you were the one who withdrew the question. And that made me think, maybe I've become too avuncular in my old age.
And
people don't think that that I am capable of this sort of thing, or think that this never happened. Perhaps because I'm from Minnesota and grew up in a small town, this this Philadelphia sophisticate believes that I'm not capable of having had these feelings.
We're used to being
patronized out here on the prairie, so that was the conclusion I leaped to.
Well, I'm really interested in the books that the character in your novel is reading, which I imagine is similar to the books that you were reading when you were in your very early teens. And these are books that describe breasts as orbs, and men have their manhood or their joystick, and there are many, many other synonyms in there. What were some of the books that you came across during that era of your life?
Pornography, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, we didn't. I didn't have any. I think that when I was 14, I came across in a used bookstore, I came across some nudist magazines. These were blurry black and white photographs of people on a distant hillside who were not wearing clothes. It took a lot of imagination to be aroused by this sort of thing. And when I was 14, I had an incredible imagination. So I found that exciting. But the sort of writing that you're referring to, this antique pornographic writing, I had to invent in the book. I was a very chaste person in most ways when I was 14.
Well, you know, one of the magazines he's reading is Wild Orgies, is High School Orgies, and I think there's another one that's like Library Orgy, or orgy in the library. And I, you know, I remember when I was a girl, one of my friends found a book hidden away in her father's dresser or something that was called Wild Orgy. And of course, we didn't know what an orgy was. And I assumed that this was about a wild guy named Orgy, kind of like Porgy.
Yes.
I mean, who knew about this stuff? So I was wondering if you had that experience of ever like discovering literature that was really intriguing to you, but was at the same time kind of like over your head sexually?
I discovered a manual in my parents' dresser drawer under some clothing. I guess I must have been looking for it, right? Why else would I have gone in there?
Looking for Christmas gifts.
I guess. I found a manual, and it was... for a manual back then, it was fairly explicit. And it used those words, which I found so exciting, just the words themselves. I guess that's how you grow up to be a writer, is when simply the word penis and the word coitus, the word vagina, are thrilling to you.
No one ever thinks that way about pornography, that it's a wonderful thing for a young person to stumble on. They'll learn a lot about language and the power of writing. But do you think that there's actually some real truth to that?
It's writing that has a big effect on you when you're young. And then you quickly move beyond it, or you're supposed to, or you learn to be secretive about it. But it has a... It has a huge effect. The effect of secrets being revealed and forbidden things talked about, and a door opened onto a scene that you were not meant to witness. This is a powerful tonic for a young reader who has read acres of stuff that is pretty predictable and in which a moral, a good moral, is painstakingly laid out, and you can see it coming a mile ahead.
Garrison Keillor speaking with Terry Gross. They'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to more of Terry's interview with Garrison Keillor. His new novel, Lake Wobegon, Summer 1956, is now out in paperback.
Well, your character decides in advance on some of the words he wants to make sure he uses in the story. Words like auspicious, thwart, drowse, entreaty, pliant, incipient. Did you do that when you were writing about sports, have lists of words you wanted to incorporate into the story?
Oh, sure, because in the Reader's Digest, which we took in our home, there was this regular monthly feature, what was it called? Building Your Word Power. And each month they gave you a list, with definitions, of course, of 10 words of that sort, auspicious, hairy, sortie. And it was your task to work them into conversation. Yes, I did that. As a kid, it was, you know, it was odd to be a little guy sitting around the supper table with your parents and your siblings and trying to get the word abstruse in there somehow.
And did you ever try to write softcore porn yourself?
I didn't, because I knew that I didn't have any experience that... that could be put down on paper and that other people would find exciting.
Mm-hmm.
That took a while. And then by the time I did have erotic experience, I had gone down the road of writing humor. And humor and eroticism don't work together.
Well,
did I just make a profound point? Or
no, I was thinking not necessarily.
Are we changing tapes?
No. I was just kind of trying to think whether that was true or not. And I was thinking they don't work together in an arousing kind of way, but it can be very funny. I mean, writing about sex can be very funny, as you prove in the book.
If it is funny, then it's not erotic.
Right, right. It's not a turn-on. Right.
If a woman having sex laughs out loud,
that's not a good thing.
how does the guy feel about this? Let's stop and think about that. I've heard of this happening, and laughter is not erotic.
Your character in the novel kind of falls in love with his slightly older cousin, and you said you had a cousin who you actually had a relationship like this with. What happened to her? Am I giving too much away if I say what happens to the cousin in the novel?
No, I don't think so.
She has a boyfriend who's part of this kind of rebellious, adventurous, ne'er-do-well type family. And she gets pregnant out of wedlock with her boyfriend. And, of course, you know, the family is just terrified and devastated, and suddenly they're going to become like the kind of people they read about in the tabloids, where something, you know, very awful has happened.
Except the boy is not terrified.
No, he's not. It's a big adventure to him.
The boy thinks to himself, go do whatever you're going to do, and I will write about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did your sister get pregnant like, your cousin, I mean, get pregnant like this?
No.
Why did you want this to happen to the character?
it simply is what happened to the character. She comes into the book at the very beginning. The boy is in love with her, and he admires her. She's a free spirit. She's a rebel. She's not afraid to get into trouble at school. She enjoys being in trouble, whereas he finds it humiliating. So he admires her courage, the courage to act up and to misbehave and to express yourself in flamboyant ways, which she does. For this girl in this town at that time, it seemed to me, writing the book, the most natural thing in the world.
Right.
That an older boy, he's 19, pitcher for the baseball team, would fall in love with her, and that her next great adventure would be in the front seat of his Pontiac. And it would have the outcome that all young women feared back in the 1950s. Women who were raised properly, of course.
When you started writing stories based on people you knew and what your family did and all of that, did you feel that as a writer it kind of gave you permission to not engage as fully in life, but rather to stand back and be the recorder of life?
If you look, as I looked when I was 14 years old, you have a tendency to hang back anyway. I was terribly shy, just painfully, excruciatingly shy as a boy. I had a terrible time just walking into a room, opening a door and walking into a room in which I knew there were people was painful for me. And I was related to those people. I mean, I knew them all. They were not strangers. They were not a jury. So for a person who is unable to be a part of social life, you may as well take notes, give yourself something to do, and then you can go back and rewrite everything that happened to you.
Garrison Keillor's autobiographical novel Lake Wobegon, Summer 1956, is now out in paperback. Coming up, a review of Autofocus, Paul Schrader's new film. This is Fresh Air. Paul Schrader's new movie, Autofocus, is based on the sexually obsessed life of TV actor Bob Crane, who was found murdered in 1978. Greg Kinnear stars as Crane. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
So I walked out of a screening of Paul Schrader's Autofocus the other day, and I heard someone say, "Wow, that was a great movie. I never want to have sex again." Now, to me, those two sentences are mutually exclusive. I'm frankly suspicious of any movie in which there's absolutely nothing to be said for consensual, recreational sex. And Schrader has a sexy subject here. His protagonist is Bob Crane, the 60s sitcom actor from Hogan's Heroes who was bludgeoned to death in a hotel room. The murder was technically unsolved, but the movie tells you who probably did it. More to the point, it tells you why Crane's life turned out so grimly. It was the lethal combination of sex, video, and celebrity. As played by Greg Kinnear, this Bob Crane is an easygoing, superficial guy who simply has a leg up on the rest of us. Thanks to his fame, he can go to bed with a different woman, or several, every night. And because the mid-60s marked the birth of a new technology, home video, and he's pals with a celebrity hanger-on who works at Sony, played by a prodigiously cretinous Willem Dafoe, Crane can videotape his conquests and relive them when he wants to, which is basically all the time. The movie starts out in a breezy style with lounge lizard music and a palette like 50s fiesta wear. But as Bob Crane's addiction estranges him from his family and derails his career, the camera gets shaky and the lighting harsh and the color like the inside of a latrine. In his last decade, Crane hits the dinner theater circuit, looking more and more pathetic as he trades on his celebrity to score. In this scene, he spies a pair of attractive women and directs the bartender to switch the TV set to a channel with reruns of Hogan's Heroes.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry to bother you. It's just that I was sitting over there and I noticed the TV and I... Well, is that you on the TV? Is that...
Oh, my gosh. That is embarrassing. I didn't even know it was on. I'm Bob Crane.
I know. I thought so. Yeah. Bob Crane. Gosh, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Oh, Susan.
Susan, all right.
I loved your TV show.
Well, appreciate that. I'm just in town here to do a little bit of theater.
I just wanted to say hi.
Sure. Can I get you something? Another drink? An autograph? A nude swim?
Bob.
You know, I'm a real photo nut. And how long are you girls in town?
The come-on actually works. Crane gets laid. But here's what you don't see in Autofocus: the pleasure of the act itself, or any human tenderness in its aftermath. Crane reportedly liked women and had fun with them. One of the creepiest things about this movie is that they seem more interchangeable and more expendable to the director than they do to the protagonist. In Paul Schrader's interview on Fresh Air, He cited the obsessive-compulsive element of Bob Crane's personality. In life, Crane didn't just catalog women and videotapes. He also cataloged things like his children's games. I thought, that's an interesting clue to this guy. Why isn't that in the movie? My guess is that Schrader found that too particular to Crane and too psychological. You can't really moralize about obsessive-compulsive behavior. A former porn movie addict from a strict Calvinist background, Schrader isn't interested in this one guy and his individual tics. Casting Greg Kinnear is a statement right there. In the Hogan's Hero scenes, Kinnear has the perfect shallow smirkiness. But in the last third, he has no depths as an actor to plumb, and Schrader has purposefully kept him a befuddled pipsqueak. The producers are Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who wrote Ed Wood and The People vs. Larry Flint and Man in the Moon, which were all biopics with a spoofy and facetious tone. What's depressing about Autofocus isn't its portrait of addiction. It's the mixture of that facetiousness with Schrader's distaste. They style Bob Crane a superficial man, and then they judge him for it. In movies, addiction is a tricky business. You don't want to glamorize it, but if you paint too dire a picture from the start, you raise the question, why would anyone want to do this stuff in the first place? I'm an admirer of movies like Drugstore Cowboy and Requiem for a Dream, anti-addiction movies that have sympathy for the ways in which people seek transcendence and end up enslaved. There's no sympathy in Schrader's depiction of Bob Crane, and no understanding of what he's trying to get from sex and video. Schrader has made Autofocus like a reformed addict who can't admit the pleasures of what once transfixed him. It's almost as if he wants you to say, wow, that was a great movie. I never want to see a movie again.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the Discovery Channel, presenting Behind the Headlines, a television event featuring Understanding Iraq and the Real Saddam, tonight at 9 p.m. on the Discovery Channel. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, An Incurable Dreamer Builds the First Civilian Spaceship by Elizabeth Weil, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, saxophonist Branford Marsalis. Growing up in America's most famous jazz family, with his father Ellis Marsalis and his brother Wynton, Branford was the one not interested. He was home listening to Elton John, Led Zeppelin, and watching Cheech and Chong. Join us for the next Fresh Air.